Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and my guest today is Diane Johnson, the author, most recently, of Le Marriage from Dutton. And they have magnanimously brought back, in paperback, from Plume, Le Divorce, Burning, Lying Low, Health and Happiness, Persian Nights, and The Shadow Knows, in no particular order, I'm afraid. And these are books that are fraught with comedy and menace. And I was very interested to note in Le Marriage the presence, as in Lying Low and as implicitly in The Shadow Knows, of a group of terrorists who provide the underlying sense that a novel of manners is not any longer what it may once have seemed to be, that threat lies at the bottom of all of our more contractual civilities.
Yes, I think that's exactly the point, that whereas the world of, I don't know, Jane Austen, her tiny village, even of George Eliot, was never menaced, now there are these subversive and menacing and actual forces. I mean, I never make anything up. These terrorists come right out of the newspapers, and they lurk behind our daily lives in a way that we can't.
Where would you say, you know, because you have a very infectious comic style, and it's even there in your tone of voice, where does it come from? Do you have any sense?
Oh, I suppose anyone's tone comes from their parents or their first grade teacher or their something in their early life. I think that my parents were skeptical and amused people, and my tone was very harmless, so that when I came out into a more active, vivid, and menacing world, I compensated with a certain animation, or I don't know.
There really is a perverse sense of humor here. One of the women in this book, Le Marriage, which is set in France, is nicknamed Pussy. The men from America, of course, find this hilarious. But imagine how funny it is to learn later still, practically in one of the last chapters, that her full name is Pussy Lautremont. And I thought, was she saving this as a climax intentionally? I just giggled out loud.
No, I wasn't saving it intentionally. It was just there. French women are called pussy sometimes, and it's considered, well, maybe the way we might call someone kitten.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But l'autrement?
L'autrement, way. Way.
Well, sometimes. Who knows? In fact, the scene where we learn that offers the, in a way, the best comparison for this book, the great French film, The Rules of the Game, which, too, is a comedy about the way in which the world besieges the precincts of a country house, and the way all sorts of outside horrors can disrupt the conventional form. And it, too, like your book, it follows the dictum of its director, Jean Renoir, that everyone has a story to tell, and everyone's story is equally valid. There's a logic and a truth that we discover as we wander among the personnel of Le Marriage that does not allow for there to be good guys, bad guys, or intermediates. They're all equally errant and equally divergent.
Yes, absolutely. I really don't approve of setting things up where there's a villain and a hero, because nobody is a villain in his own eyes. And so it's more the clash of divergent points of view, just exactly as you said, that interests me. And then when you complicate that with French points of view versus American points of view, bringing to bear the whole clash of cultures, I find that even more interesting.
Am I wrong? This seems to be the most elaborately plotted of your novels.
Yeah, I think it is, absolutely.
Is it possible that the happiness of having achieved some recognition with the divorce after such a career of admired but ignored books gave you the energy to plot this so densely? Because the book seeps a kind of joy and inventiveness.
Yeah, I think that was partly it, that I did feel sort of free to elaborate on some of the things that I'd gotten started with in Le Divorce. And the other thing is living in France itself, which is somehow being outside your own culture is liberating. I'm living over there, and I can look back at American themes and situations in a kind of freer way somehow. The other thing is that you're actually freer in France because you don't have to drive the car. You don't have to.
Now, many times you have identified yourself more with the forces of the outsider forces than with the powers that be. I remember being impressed when the essays on terrorism first appeared in the New York Review of Books, or the essay on Patty Hearst, others as well. But what draws you to the sinister?
I really can't account for that, because I come from such a benign culture, that is, small town Illinois, where there really did not seem to be an undercurrent of menace. I think it perhaps is the interface between that world and the real world of contemporary America, which I found so shocking once I emerged as a, you know, at the end of my teenage years, to find that the world was different.
Because you had moved to California basically from the Midwest.
Yeah.
Moved to Northern California after Los Angeles, and then a series of travels began, mostly owing to the fact that your husband is a doctor, an international tuberculosis doctor,
yeah.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so now you've seen the world, which makes for a much larger kind of novel, it seems to me.
Well, it's certainly a more interesting, for me, place to be, living somewhere, seeing things from a larger perspective than I could have ever had if I hadn't left Illinois. And I think also that actually few American writers are positioned by circumstances in other countries. So it gives me a shot at saying something that maybe not everybody is saying about the way American cultural influences impact on other countries and vice versa, but mainly how other people see us, things like that, that now fascinates me a lot.
I was curious about the epigraph of the book. It's so different in tone from the book itself. I'll read it just so that we can discuss it. It's from a Thomas Mann essay on Kafka. What the artist calls good, the object of all his playful pains, his life and death jesting, is nothing less than a parable of the right and the good, a representation of all human striving after perfection. That's Thomas Mann in his homage to Kafka. Now, what brought that to the front of this book?
I see that may seem a bit off the wall, but in part it was my great reverence for Mann and for Kafka. But also, I think I was trying to say, look, this may seem like a funny book or light, but it really has a deeper, I hope, preoccupation with the good and the right. And that its subject is, at some level, moral convictions.
Yes, I found that its subject, to me, seemed to be the need people have to create order.
Yes.
And that can be nations, that is to say, to become something called French or something called American,
yeah,
to create something called a marriage, which is full of convention, but really all of this being a wall built to forestall panic.
Yes, although maybe, yes, it does forestall panic, but I'm not sure that's why you build the wall. There are other... I also wanted to get at the fact that Americans have the luxury to operate from principle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if they don't succeed in imposing their principles on other cultures, it's something that we take for granted, that we represent the right and the good.
Mm.
The hunting scenario, for example.
Yes, there's a character modeled loosely on Stanley Kubrick, a film director who lives reclusively in the French countryside in a manner that he's trying to protect the grounds of the manor from the incursions of hunters. Everyone is trying to hold away the strange as a group of terrorists, as a group of hunters, as a group of attack dogs. Everyone's being attacked or counterattacked,
yes,
by something. And they're all trying to create boundaries,
yes,
which will allow them to live ideally without intervention.
Exactly. I guess that's what you meant by walls. Exactly.
Yes.
Boundaries.
Yes.
Fortress sort of walls. Yeah.
Well, why does this concern you? Because it is, you know, in all of these books, that starting with The Shadow Knows, there's an other,
yeah,
a capital O other, who is completely outside the world of suburban concerns or the world of you name it, and the books tend to watch the efforts of that other to enter. In The Shadow Knows and Lying Low, the other enters most deeply. There's a kind of vampiric element. In these more recent books, that other is kept at some distance, or there is a success in
yes, I suppose it comes from this emergence into the world that I mentioned, from a relatively sheltered, a completely sheltered, you know, sort of middle-class American.
Well, surely it's the issue of the generation you grew up around. I was born into it, but that question of accepting a world that you had been told was foreign, was different, was completely, you know, socially unacceptable, that this world should be at the door.
Yeah.
And not only at the door, but one has a curiosity. What is it like to answer
exactly
the door?
Exactly. Would I like it if I actually got out there into it and so on? I think it might be a very female thing, to a female set of preoccupations, because women are normally sort of encouraged to live in a more cloistered environment. Certainly in my generation, that was the case. So you actually were not ever at risk for having to experience too much of the actual world, which was always presented as the other, whether it was men, foreigners, big city people. There are a whole set of others that we all deal with, and now America, of course, deals with the world in a rather inept way,
mm-hmm,
because we have not really succeeded in accommodating a conception of the other except to demonize it.
I'm speaking to Diane Johnson about her new novel, Le Marriage, published by Dutton. Now, you've been writing an essay on a writer's themes, and you've now done, what, 9 novels?
I'd have to count them. I think 9, yeah, let's say.
At what point, I assume that you're told you have themes before you agree to having,
yes,
them.
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at this essay. It's for the New York Times. You know that series they have, Writers on Writing, and they, mm-hmm, said, well, write something. And then I wasn't writing because I was going on this book tour in which people said, well, what is the theme of your novel? And so I thought, well, exactly what you just said. The writer doesn't really think of these themes, although midway through or three-quarters of the way through writing a novel, you might then see what it's about and be able to strengthen those themes. And we all agree that there are themes in novels, but what their role is and how to speak of them is not so clear because it's a rather despised topic, sort of high school sounding.
Well, I rather think, in fact, that most of the people who want to write novels and can't are people who believe that novels should have themes, and they worry themselves so much about themes and meanings that they can't really start.
Do you think that that's the paralyzing thing?
I think that must, you know.
But then what do people start from?
People who manage to start
to finish their novel
have a an ability to suspend that need for meaning and to be able to go through this labyrinth not exactly knowing what is to be found at the end, but knowing when it's being interesting and
what's
not.
And that it will be found.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think I think that's probably right. Maybe with your first novel, you have more of a tendency to impose a theme, but eventually comes a kind of trust that themes are there, they're coming out of your unconsciousness or the daily life of the world or wherever they come from. They will be discoverable, and you don't need to concern yourself with them.
Now tell me, do you feel you have an unconscious?
Yes, I do. I don't place a lot. I don't think about it very much, but I know that it's the thing that presents me with literary solutions when I wake up in the morning. I think almost any writer would agree that there is an unconscious process that you can program yourself before you go to bed. Should they go to Cleveland or Cincinnati? And then you wake up in the morning knowing that they have to go to Cincinnati. It's just very mysterious.
Because I'm convinced that the reason Kubrick came to you for The Shining was the sense in The Shadow Knows that the unconscious was on the attack and was now entering the physical presence of the heroine to an enormous extent that she remains unaware of, and that's in her unawareness is what remains so frightening in that book. And so I've really, since then, regarded you as a novelist with a huge...
a huge unconscious. A largely unconscious novelist.
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think that these books are held together with funny pins of the unconscious. Puns link things together, little jokes. There's a great sense that it can be like that wedding dress that can't be expanded. This is like a wedding dress that can be expanded. There's a bride in the novel who doesn't fit into her dress when she comes back from America because, well, we're so fat here and we eat such fatty food, she can no longer fit her dress and she can't find darts or any way to expand the dress. But your novel is like, well, what did they say? A loose baggy monster. And with the emphasis on monster.
Yes, this capacity the novel has for containing anything that you choose to stuff into it, like a big sack, or and then the way it becomes monstrous on its own, it achieves this shape and energy that you realize that you've set loose but can't entirely control. And I know that it's a bit odd to speak of this process, but almost every writer does, as being so unconscious. But since we're talking about the unconscious, of course it's not unconscious. You're sitting down and you're putting words in front of each other, but there is this mysterious way that characters take life or do things that you don't expect. And so many people have testified to this that I can't be making it up.
Because what I've found in Le Marriage, I think that every chapter partakes of something that's true of the whole. Each chapter moves the narrative forward in terms of event, but the chapters are carefully arranged so that there is no consequence. The book expresses life as being one in which upheavals occur moment by moment, but they subside eventually. A lost manuscript is found, a threat is removed, a law is changed. Gradually, if you don't get too lost in the projection, if you stay at the surface of life, the thing that has arisen to frighten you will disappear again. So you get this chapter that begins with event and ends with irresolution.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Like life itself.
Like life itself.
You know, you get a lump and then you go for a biopsy and then the biopsy is benign or whatever. You know, it's kind of this, it's like the surface of the sea or something with the waves, but hardly ever a tidal wave.
Mm-hmm. In order to finish these novels, it seems to me that the lump turns out to be benign. Even if the lump turns out not to be benign, in order to cope, we have to act as if all consequences can be coped with.
Yeah, which is pretty much how we have to live our lives. Because if not, what would become of us?
There are people who live in a continual state of nervous arrest.
True, but then they don't get their novels written.
You see, so I think that unconsciously the structuring principle is the principle of coping. Another chapter, another chapter.
Yeah, coping or accommodation. The little concessions one has to make with the absolute or with the ideal.
Which is, it seems to me, the theme of any marriage.
Which is the theme of any marriage, and certainly the theme, one of the themes of this book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, in that particular schematic, you have said a number of times that you have made these travels as an accommodation to your husband's career. How does that affect your writing, and are you good at that kind of accommodation?
Yes, I think so. I don't really depend on having one place. And in fact, I think I prefer to be a little bit en route, because then I'm not responsible for the surroundings as I would be if I were always in my own kitchen.
You'd be held responsible. Yeah. Oh, how funny. That's very interesting. But what about the writing, the scene of writing? Most writers have all sorts of peculiar ideas about their study or their equipment or their ink or their paper. Not for you.
No, I don't. I do like to have plain, unlined, yellow Bond. And I must write with an ink pen, but except for that.
It doesn't matter where the room is.
It doesn't matter where the room is, no. I like it to be small and plain.
This is as opposed to the Kubrick character in the novel, who is very precise about what he needs at any given moment and arranges for minions to have it there for him.
Yeah. Well, dare I say that it's more of a man thing. When I think of male writers and female writers that I know, men and women writers, women almost always have to get out of the house and into some neutral surroundings because of this responsibility for the domestic surroundings. And men normally ordain their study as a place that they can be pandered to and where they're doing their important work. That's Jack, you know, in the hotel, in The Shining.
The other writer figure in The Marriage is Estelle, the bride's mother, who is sort of a postmodern Colette, in a sense.
Yes,
she's
exactly.
A still more intensely vibrating recorder of the biological sensations of sexuality in poetic terms. Had she a model? She's so funny.
Well, Colette, you hit it exactly. I mean, what I did was read some of those early Claudine novels in which Colette is very risque about the biological. And then and I sort of put Estelle in to amuse my own children, who have always dreaded reading anything I wrote, lest it be embarrassing, you know, from their mother. So I always thought how embarrassed Colette's, what I write is very mild, but what Colette wrote was not mild, and what did her children think, and so on. So anyway, that was the origin.
Is that why the major son in this book, the child, is deaf?
Maybe. Maybe.
Can't hear what the parents
are. Spared a whole lot of parental discourse, yeah.
Now, finally, I can't allow a conversation about a book called Le Marriage to end without asking you what marriage, once the end of a social comedy, what marriage is now? What does it represent in a novel?
Well, I think it still probably represents, officially anyway, the same things that the whole comic tradition has it represent, which is happiness. Perhaps the comic spirit always qualifies that happiness. We know when the people get married that they're going to have to undergo all the ups and downs that regular mortals undergo. But it, anyway, marriage at the end of a comedy signifies optimism. It's a kind of homage to the future. And it's even a possible human condition.
And that still operates, you
And
feel.
I think that still operates. I don't know, doesn't it?
Because marriage for me in the novel signifies resolution. And
yes.
In your novels, I find it impossible to use the word resolution.
Well, yeah, it's true. It's true that I didn't want to imply that everything would always go well with Tim and Anne Sophie, you know, or anything like that kind of resolution. But at least it's a nod to the future. It's like giving it the best possible try.
It's not every day, it seems to me, that a novelist who is aware of the modern world will do the old-fashioned thing and end with
comedy.
A marriage.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know. That was always my game in this, you know, plan in this novel, that it would have that ending of the sort of Jane Austen ending, or, you know, the 18th century, the conventional ending of comedy where the characters get married. Only now we know, because it's modern life, that there are all these more realistic considerations.
They'll make it work somehow.
They'll make it, or they won't. You know?
It doesn't matter, but it will
matter.
End with marriage.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. I've been speaking to Diane Johnson about her new novel, Le Marriage. Diane, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.